You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
Again, thank you for being here. We would now like to make some sense of what's going on with all of these changes with continuing resolutions, budget cuts, and sequestration with a very, very capable couple of individuals who have been in this field in various capacities for many years and very thoughtful. I've learned a lot from both of them. To my side is my former boss, Jack Mayer, who was at the Congressional Budget Office when we worked together. He's also been at the Center for Naval Analyses. He's now a senior vice president at Booz Allen Hamilton. He's a West Point grad, an Army veteran, and also just a very thoughtful leader on many issues, ran the Homeland Security and Defense Business Council for a number of years, as well as his many other activities in the area of charitable and volunteer nature, but has thought about defense budget and strategy issues as well as anybody for decades. Next to him is Jay DeFrank, who is a vice president at Pratt & Whitney, part of United Technologies, a very important player in a number of areas of defense technology. Obviously, we want to bring in the voices from industry as well as from the military services as we think about what's happening with sequestration, although Jay also, just like Jack, has military experience and spent 3 decades in the U.S. Air Force before joining Pratt & Whitney. And so, gentlemen, thank you for being here. And what I'd like to do, we have a little more time in this panel for involving the audience as well, but there are really two main subjects I'd like to get your thoughts on as we launch into this. And one is just to reflect on what we've just heard, not only the specific stories and anecdotes and factoids and impressions that we heard from these five officers, but your own tracking of what's happening under this unusual budgetary environment. And again, it's a big question, big subject, so I'm really just asking you for the impressions that are most on your mind, things that you most want to get into the conversation at this moment, given where we've been in the last hour. And then after we've done that, I'd like to talk more generally about where the defense budget should go, in your judgment, at a time when we're asking Congress to answer that question, we're asking the president to answer that question, but we're in a great deal of turbulence and uncertainty about where things really are headed. So I'll repose that question in a second, but if I could just begin, you know, what's on your mind, Jack, as you listen to this group, as you watch what's going on in town and in the services today?
So, Michael, I find it very, very difficult to assess the implications of what's going on right now. I remember back in the 80s when we went through Graham Rudman, and I was at CBO, and they did sequestration. Everyone walked away from that saying, we never do that again. And so all the way up until last year, I said, nope, Congress will walk away from it. They won't do sequestration. They learned how it doesn't work, and it's a bad way to be able to run a country, and we did it. And a month ago, I said that we wouldn't shut down the government. We did that back in the 90s. Nobody won on that. There were only losers in that. Nobody would actually push it to the brink and go ahead and do that again. And of course, we did it again, and we did it for almost 3 weeks. So I certainly won't even go out on a limb and to say what's going to happen in a month from now or 2 months from now in the middle of the January, because I really can't believe some of the rhetoric that I hear that we'll never do it again, and we've experienced it. So I think that those uncertainties compound the things that are going on right now in defense and what's going on in the country, because I don't think you can decouple what's going on in defense and what's going on in the country. I mean, in defense, we're coming back from fighting a war. We've declared that we're going to be out of Afghanistan in 2014. So they're not fighting anymore. And as soon as you stop fighting and the world view changes of what's going on, there's going to be a complete restructuring and there's going to be less money. I mean, that's the reality. I mean, how that restructuring is done, what the money is going to be, I think, is different. But we've also got the pressures that are going on right now in the country in terms of how big a government do we actually want. And before, you used to be able to say that, at least on the Republican side, that the Republicans were very pro-defense and they were going to fund defense. And then the Democratic side, they were pro-social programs and they were going to fund that, and you get some balance in between. I don't think you can even say that anymore, because although the Democrats, I think, are still very much pro-social, I can't say that the Republican Party is very much pro-defense, because we've seen those that have very articulate and have strong voices in the Republican Party who have been talking about having a much smaller defense budget, who are very much isolationist and don't want us to be as engaged as we've been before. So I think any predictability about where we would go based on what we knew political scenes used to be is gone out of the equation. And I think we're in a whole new game, and being able to predict what that game is going to be is, I think, very, very difficult right now.
Thank you. Yeah. Jay.
Thanks, Mike. I think about the comments that you made at the beginning about sequestration and basically the sky hasn't fallen. And I think that there was one word missing. That's yet.
Right.
I think about it like the person who falls off the observation platform on top of the Empire State Building, and they're going by the 40th floor thinking, I'm okay for now. If this continues as it is continuing, the effects will be incremental at first and then trend towards exponential. And I'll say a little bit more about why I think that. So this year, not much happened. And full disclosure, I chaired the AIA's campaign, second to none, the steering group. But I did caution them. I was no fan of the countdown clocks. And my concern was just what happened is that come January 1st, or in this case, March 1st, sequestration went into effect. The effects weren't going to really be felt at first for a lot of reasons. You had the unobligated fiscal year 11 and 12 dollars. You had the obligated fiscal year 12 and 13 dollars still to cycle through the system. So there, and the effects on readiness were going to take time to accumulate. So the odds of really feeling a substantial effect in the defense arena the first year were probably going to be minimal. And those people who look at it and say, well, it's not so bad, and so, a little bit more is good. Or you get people on the Republican side who are the deficit hawks, who think that the greatest threat to national security is the deficit. And, I've actually heard this on a number of occasions, that, well, at least the deficit's coming down, so some good is coming of this. And it reminds me of the person with a terminal case of a wasting cancer saying, but at least I'm losing weight. Yes, the deficit's coming down, but it's not coming down in the right way and in a way that's really going to be productive for the nation. And it seems that on the DOD side and in many circles of government, the strategy for sequestration is hope. I was always taught when I was in the military that hope's not a strategy. That, but there seems to be this hope that even institutionally for a while, the military services weren't allowed to plan for sequestration cuts in there because the hope was that somebody was going to deal with sequestration. But so this year, the effects weren't so great. Now, if there's a CR, then we met with our corporate political consultants. We have some of the, I'd say, the best in the town representing both sides of the aisle. We were at our meeting today, and we were talking about sequestration, CRs, just these same subjects. And the consensus was that there'd be a CR, and then the sequestration cuts would be imposed on top of that, which is a substantial cut from the current year's budget. This is for 14. If that's the case, and the head of our government relations department for United Technologies polled the consultants, how many thought that was the likely scenario? And it was about 2-1 that was the likely scenario. And they took an optimistic message away from that, because 2 weeks ago the idea that was going to happen was 3-1. So, there's things were improving a little bit in that area. But then if you take that and then add the next year's cuts and then the next year's cuts and then the next year's cuts on the already reduced amounts and the effects that they would have, we get into an area where there's some significant threats. And I think it gets to long-term ramifications of who we are and what we want to do as a nation. I mean, do we want to be a nation that is able to shape our national security environment, our geopolitical environment, or one that reacts? Again, going back to my early training as a military officer, I was taught that it's 6 times more expensive to be on defense than offense. Now, I don't know if those numbers still hold, but if we're in a reactive mode, then we're going to be spending a lot of our resources responding to the environment rather than shaping them in a way that's favorable to our nation. So sequestration is by no means the only driver. I mean, many of the budget issues that we have, our inability to plan and things of that nature affect it. But I think that we're setting ourselves up for some really significant issues. We think we're solving, some people at least think we're solving a problem, the deficit spending, in a way that I think could actually be, in the long term, very harmful for the nation.
Now, here's a question, again, on the taking an even broader view that I understand you may not want to answer quantitatively, but I'm going to put it in quantitative terms. And the basic question is, what should the defense budget be, or, if you prefer, rather than have sequestration, what should the alternative package of additional defense deficit reduction measures be in the next 10 years? So, again, to remind folks, and I think this crowd needs little reminding, but we've already got one tranche of Budget Control Act reductions before sequestration, and I'll take that sort of as our premise of our starting point, and maybe you all like that starting point or not. Maybe you think that's already cutting too much. But anyway, that's the first round of cuts. Then on top of that, sequestration is not only a mechanism for the way in which cuts are carried out, but it's associated with another $500 billion in 10-year reductions, as I think most of you know. And separate from all of that is the reduction in war costs, which we're sort of considering as a separate matter because that's basically tied directly to how many forces we have in the field. There's less controversy about what that should be. It should fund whatever operations we've got, which may be controversial in themselves, but once we decide to do them, most of the country agrees we should pay for them. Anyway, that's the context. Sequestration, therefore, would cut this additional $500 billion over 10 years. Is that number too big? Is that too much of a defense budget cut? That would result in an overall real defense spending level, once you take away the war costs, of something around $500 billion, if you count Department of Energy nuclear weapons. So let's just use a nice round number of $500 billion, if you want to count everything. But the defense budget has been up around $700 billion at the peak of the war, when you count the war costs plus other things as well, even more than $700 billion. In the Cold War, it was sort of averaging around where we're headed. You know, the Cold War average, if you put it in 2013 dollars, somewhere in the 450, 475 range. So we're headed down to about that or a little above that. Anyway, enough of my setting the baseline for discussion. What do you think the defense budget should be, if you're comfortable answering the question in that way?
So I won't give you a should. I think there are two different ways to be able to look at this, all right? And I tend to think you either got to do it bottom up or top down. And if I took it from a bottom up perspective, I go back to 2001 and I look at the forces that I had in 2001 and I say, were those forces ready and able for what they were going to be asked to do? And I think the answer is yes. Okay, that didn't mean that they were sufficient for what was going to happen over the next decade, but certainly in order to be able to react to unknown circumstances, they were able to do that. And I look at that and how much we spent then in 2001, it was $305 billion. And if I just take that number, I adjust it for inflation up to 2013, that puts me at about $405 billion. And so I say, okay, if nothing else changed, I just had those forces, and I funded it at the level that I was, I got a base that's somewhere of $405 billion. I don't think that's enough, but that's a base where I put it. Mm-hmm. And so then I start building on that as to what is different about the forces. What has happened in terms of technology? What are the things that I need to be able to have that I know now that I didn't know then that's advanced? And I start building on that. I probably wouldn't be building force structure on that. And I think there's a lot of good evidence of why I wouldn't. So, for instance, if I look at the Navy right now, the Navy was 377,000 people in 2001, and it's only 325,000 now. So it's a smaller Navy than what we had then, and I'll accept the fact that the size is adequate. I look at the Air Force was 353,000 then, it's 333,000 now. So I'll say that that's sufficient. If I look back at the Army, it was 480,000 then. It's going to 490,000 by 2017, according to Army plans right now. So it's back down into that range. And the Marine Corps was 173,000 then, it's 203,000 now, 30,000 that you would probably bring that down to. So the size of the force structure sounds to me that it's about right in the direction that the plans are going. The question is about the size of the modernization and the types of the equipment and things that you need. So that's where I would start if I was going from the bottom up. If I was going from the top down, I think I've got to start with the strategy. But the problem I've got with just starting with the strategy is I have to lock it in with the fiscal reality, which means that because the president is responsible for determining what the military strategy will be, the Congress is responsible for determining the resources that will be allocated to exercise that strategy. And so when I think of things from my business perspective, I can't talk about stuff I want to do unless I have the reality of the resources to be able to pay for it. And I think that that's an iterative price to get there. So I can't say that I'm going to have a strategy to do this, have the military says, well, then I need the forces to do this, have a Congress that says, well, I'm going to resource you with that and expect myself to be able to execute a strategy, all right, unless I'm going to fund it for the resources that it says. I don't think the Congress is willing to give the resources to the president and to the military that it would be necessary to execute the strategy, assuming that the budget of the president reflects that. Mm. So then you put it down at somewhere right on the $498 million or billion dollars that you get with the 2014 sequester, and then it does grow from that, okay? Not as high as the president was going, but it grows every year from that. So what is a strategy that those types of resources support? And is that a strategy then that the people who resource this country, reflect supposedly the will of the American people, is that a strategy that they're willing to stick with, support, and be able to do it to make sure that you've got the forces to execute it? So I didn't give you a number. I can't give you a number, Michael. I was never good at giving an individual number. But, I mean, I think those are the two different ways to be able to look at it.
And if I'm – just one quick follow-up. If I'm following correctly, and I appreciate that's a very useful framing, and the framing sort of converges on something in the broad 400s or the higher half of the $400 billion range, right? Because your first approach, you said you'd get up to $400 billion by inflating, but you needed to add some things on. And the procurement holiday of the 90s, presumably cyber, whatever else. So you're up into the, I don't know, you didn't give a number, but maybe into the mid 400s. Your other approach brought you down to around 500. It seems like you would say we're in a reasonable realm of discussion with, even with sequestration. We're not out of bounds of what might be reasonable or at least predictable given where the politics of the country are.
If we're starting at 2014, but then I think that I accept that the Congress will continue to increase above a 498 number because that was a sequester number that they signed up to and that they've got small increases in a year after that. So, I mean, I think in terms of if I'm thinking from a strategy perspective, if I believe that they're willing to resource it there. What I don't know for sure is when I think from the builder from the bottom up and the minimum is 400 plus, I don't know how much the plus is that way.
Right. Jay.
I think there are a couple of considerations I'd like to build maybe a little bit on what Jack said. You know, I see a lot of budget projections and analyses that go back from the end of World War II and track what the defense budgets have done through the time, and it's sort of a wavy chart there because after every major military engagement, the budgets come down, and then they go back up a bit. And so you can look at any given point and say, A, we're in a relatively normal pattern. We're coming off of the 9/11 two wars that have followed that. The Cold War is over. So it's about time that we draw down from that period of time and go back, like Jack said, to the 2001 levels and what did it look like and what it was sufficient. But what I don't see coming into those analyses often are two things. One is, where were we in the state of recapitalization during those times? I was on active duty when the Vietnam War ended and we rolled into what became the Hollow Force, right? And decisions were made, and it turns out in retrospect, good decisions to sacrifice readiness in order to bring on the next generation of modernization or recapitalization. So from the Air Force perspective, we moved from the era of A-7s and F-4s and that generation of aircraft to the fourth generation of aircraft, F-15s, F-16s, A-10s, and to in the Navy side to the F-14s and F-18s. And they were largely from the tactical air power perspective. What has sustained us right up until the current state as we move now into, a large, more fifth-generation fleet? If those decisions had been made differently, we wouldn't have had those assets during that time, but it was a trade-off with readiness. I don't often see people look at, and I am very conscious of correlation doesn't equal causation, but if you look at what happened in the world during that time when we traded off readiness after the end of the Vietnam War, you had, Laos, Cambodia fell, you had insurgencies in Angola and Ethiopia, you had, Cuban forces fighting there, you had insurgencies in Central America, you had then the U.S. embassy fall in Iran and Iran tumble, and then the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan until we had actually basically reconstituted our force and brought our readiness levels up and reached a certain degree of geopolitical stability after that. And then we went into the Reagan buildup, the fall of the Cold War, and we know the history there. But I think that those analyses are incomplete of where we were with the budget until you look at what had to be done and where we were in the modernization cycle. So now where are we in the modernization cycle? We've about used up the aircraft resources that were built up during that time, and it's time, if we still see a viable role for tactical aviation, that we need to recapitalize that fleet. We're flying Eisenhower-era tankers. Well, we've got a tanker out there now that's being built. It'd be pretty hard not to do that, and it's what the number two priority, I think General Walt said F-35 was his top. Tanker was number two, and I forget which was number three. Oh, long-range strike was number three, said the other day. And those are all things that have to be done, but they require resources again to do it. And I think you can look across the services and you'd see that we're at that point where it's time to recapitalize. Now, again, it's easy to draw the wrong conclusions from the past because we had assets that lasted a long time. We had airframes lasting more than 50 years because they were over-engineered at the time they were built. I once asked one of the aircraft designers who I knew why bombers were still flying at 50 years and they had the structural lifespan to fly another 30 or 40 years when fighters were having to be retired after 22, 25 years. And the answer was because we've gotten a lot better at our engineering and at predicting the lifespan of the aircraft, and that's happening again. But I think if people see what's happened in the past with over-engineered airframes, and you see that in the civil market too. Boeing aircraft that are 30 years old are taken apart, and they see that they've got another 30 years worth of life on the airframe, which is far more than was expected because they were so over-engineered at the time. So I think that's one thing that that we have to consider is where we are in the cycle of recapitalization and modernization. The other thing that we have to think about is what are the missions? I heard Secretary Hagel at CSIS the other day talk about six priorities, and he was talking about missions in those and the importance of cyberspace, space, and then all of the other modernization, personnel, the whole thing there. And it was very interesting because at a time when we're looking at our budgets, what I saw in there was a couple of extra mission areas that really weren't a primary focus either in 2001 or in the cycles before there. What are the real threats we're facing? Well, I don't see any of our traditional mission areas going away or going down as new ones come on, but now we have cyber. Now we have defense of our space assets. I think a lot of people think that they take what we're doing in space for granted, yet much of what we're doing there is so woven into the fabric of our everyday life that it's become invisible. But if you were an adversary looking at our vulnerabilities, there's a key vulnerability there. If you look at cybersecurity, if we don't keep up with that, it doesn't matter if you take out infrastructure kinetically or electronically, you're still vulnerable there. So you have our traditional mission areas haven't gone away. When you have a couple of additional mission areas, at a time when you have to recapitalize, and I think then you have to look at the budget in terms of, because budgets are what turn your intentions into reality, is what do we intend to do and how do we make that a reality? And so are there areas where we can come down? I mean, maybe in size of force structure, but there are other areas that require a key focus, and I think that takes you, that would help if you... And there's one other factor I didn't mention, and that's the politically possible factor. I've said this at panels here before. You know, a lot of budget people look at the defense budget and say, over the period of sequestration, I could take out $100, $200 billion easy. I think we all could, because there are a lot of things there that don't make sense in today's environment, but they're not in the realm of the politically possible. Everything that Department of Defense does has a constituency, and that's a constituency that's willing to fight very hard. Base closures and realignments, aging assets in the Guard and Reserves and changing missions. I mean, you could go on. The personnel part of the budget. You know, Hagel said the other day in one of his six priorities on personnel that the costs for compensation on the personnel side are half of the budget. So what you're going to end up is one of the best paid forces without the resources to do their jobs. And you know, there's a constituency for all those things that make it hard to do what looks easy if you just take an objective look at the budget. So do you plan for that, what, for want of a better word, that slop in the budget, or can you create a budget, a realistic budget, that actually addresses those issues?
Thanks. Jack.
Jay, I also saw what the Secretary said in terms of the six priorities, but I was struck by some of the things that were not in the priorities, okay, which would have been things that were there traditionally. I think one of the things that the services have to really be careful about is the in the debate that's going on and will be going on for a while, is overstating some of the issues. And I know that there are things that do not help when people, in my opinion, when people say it. And I will cite General Odierno yesterday. And he referred to the cost of a soldier. Now, that was a new metric to me, that you're talking about the cost of a soldier. But he said that had doubled since 2001. But he says it's going to double again by 2025. Now, if that is a valid metric, we cannot afford many of them. Certainly we can't afford them the way we've used them now. I mean, they become too precious an asset for us to be able to use. And so if that's real, and that's where the Army feels it has to go with its soldiers, then you start saying, well, how can I afford anywhere near the 480,000 at this price? I have to only be using them what I bought them for, which is to deter or to fight wars, not to be doing other things. And then I look at how I get substitute labor to be doing the other things. So I think we got to be careful about when we talk about these things and what costs are, that we don't say things that may put in jeopardy in the future, and that you're making the cost look so great that people throw their hands up and say, well, I just can't do it.
Yep. Well, let's involve you. Please, again, wait for the microphone. Tell us your name and pose a question. Start Lily in the back. So,
Lily Chen, pre-doc research fellow at Brookings. I have a question regarding the strategy. My question is, if you look down the trend of the resources reduction, what will be the reasonable military strategy, say, within 5 to 10 years, given all the constraints in budgets? I'm more familiar with the Chinese PLA thinking. When the PLA is planning their own strategy, the U.S. weighs heavily in their mind, because in any frictions, the PLA is going to get into, they have to consider the possible intervention from the U.S. side. So when I listen to your conversation, I'm thinking everything the U.S. will do with the military strategy adjustment will actually affect many other countries' military strategies. Thank you.
I mean, I'll try to say something there. I'm not sure that I'll even come close to answering the question. You know, typically what happens when the U.S. develops its strategy, it's looking at what the world view is and where they see that there are, I would say, competitors to its influence. And it's very clear that as we're not particularly worried about Europe, doesn't mean that we're going to walk away from Europe, but we're not particularly worried about Europe. And there's a great, I think, consensus in this country that the Europeans need to be first in terms of any defense of themselves. I think that we're less likely to be involved in any ground type of operation in the Middle East. If you look at what happened after Vietnam, we said we weren't going back to Southeast Asia and be involved in a ground war, and we were true to that for 10, 15, 20 years before we were going to get involved in that. I think we'll still be engaged, but the engagement is going to be much more with special operations and missiles that are pinpointing, we're trying to pinpoint attacks. So that leaves, the Pacific, the other part of the world. And, you know, you've got China that is becoming a large economic competitor to the United States. And so I think, and you've got North Korea that is a country that is completely unpredictable and could create all sorts of havoc, intentionally or unintentionally, that forces us to react whether we want to or not. And so I think that there becomes a big shift in terms of how our thinking is in terms of a global strategy. And I think China has to be in the forefront of that.
I mean, I think to kind of build on that a little bit, that if you look at, on a macro basis, the U.S. strategic objectives are to ensure a type of stability that's favorable to our interests. And what does it take to ensure that type of stability? And like Jack said, right now, the area that looks like it has the potential to be less stable for the degree of impact on our interest would be in the Pacific region. And that's where our strategic focus is. That's one of the drivers behind the technology we're developing, such as the F-35 and, you know, a driver behind the long-range strike capability and others, our naval, you know, some of our naval assets. And I think rather than being directed in any specific mission area, it's what would be required to shape the events or to shape things. And I'll define that in a way. When you have an advanced fighter, for example, that is far more capable than anybody else is. It's a very expensive asset. Training's expensive. Operation is expensive. If other nations know that they cannot fly against you and succeed, they're not going to develop them. And so, I mean, that's one of the rationales why there aren't very many advanced fighters fielded around the world or evolving, being produced and fielded around the world. The image that always sticks in my mind is the Iraqi MiG-25 buried in the desert, right? Because if they thought it was going to get destroyed, why would they fly it? That's exactly what you would want, is to have that kind of shaping effect. So I think developing the type of force with an appropriate foresight to be able to shape the environment. You know, it's following the method of Sun Tzu, the acme of skill is to win the battle without fighting it. If you can shape events and prevent a conflict, then you're far better off than if you actually have to have it. So to have a strategy and to have the force structure, including the technology, to be able to ensure stability in the Pacific region would be a key strategic objective that would not necessarily drive you to conflict, but would actually prevent it and maintain that stability.
I'm going to answer this one myself, if you don't mind, which is a way that's, I think, consistent with what we've just heard, but just puts it in a different light. I would propose three pillars for future American defense strategy and planning, and one of them is to essentially preserve the believability of the Asia-Pacific rebalance. Now, that's a strategy that's partly diplomatic and economic, not just military, But one of the interesting things about it, it had very modest military elements. If you go look at what happened, you know, 2,500 Marines in Darwin, Australia, which is a long ways away from most of the places we actually care about in that region and are worried about. Four littoral combat ships, largely rotating through Singapore. Again, very modest individual pieces. But the Navy has said it wants to put 60% of its fleet on Pacific-oriented ports. And maybe that's the single biggest piece of change. But here's the thing. And I like, by the way, I like the rebalance. I like the fact that it's not too hot, not too cold, that it is a mix of diplomatic, economic tools, and only a few modest military pieces. But if these few modest military pieces, which are trying to push your capability modestly up, are trumped by an overall downward press on the U.S. military capability, you can try to protect the Asia-Pacific rebalance to an extent, but you can't do it indefinitely if the defense budget cuts get really big. And so let me just put it to you one very straightforward way in mathematical terms. The Navy wants to have, again, 60% of the fleet in the Asia-Pacific region. Now, actually, some of that fleet could still go to the Persian Gulf, even from Pacific ports. So this is an upper bound on what the Navy will do to increase its capability. Okay, now, but if the fleet comes down in size, but the percentage for the Pacific goes up, you could say, what's the break-even point? Well, the break-even point is when the fleet's about 85 to 90% of what it was. When it's in that range, 85 to 90% of what it was, 60% of that smaller fleet is the same as what you started with. So the whole logic of the rebalance is largely lost to me, or at least it's put in jeopardy. So I would say you don't want a defense strategy that cuts your Navy by anything more than, let's say, at most 10%. The Navy would prefer to have the fleet go up by 10%, but I would at least prefer that it not go down by 10% or more. That would be one piece. On the Army, and General Odierno is now testifying to this effect because he's obliged to, given the sequestration scenarios that are before him, but what I've been arguing for is what I call a 1+2 framework for the Army and the Air Force fighter jets as well, to a large extent. And what I mean is one major regional war at a time and two prolonged multilateral stabilization missions. The one war capability is sort of where we've been trending in the gradual shift in quadrennial defense reviews over the years. We still hope that we can do a little more than one, if you read the last quadrennial defense review and the defense strategic guidance of 2012. But we're hoping that we could still do something in a second war at the same time that we fought the first one to complete victory. I'm actually proposing we scale back even that lesser requirement and have a robust one regional war capability for the ground combat forces, but be able to do two prolonged stabilization missions. And the stabilization missions could be, let's say, Afghanistan post-2014. They could be, in a couple of years, Syria. You probably think I'm crazy, but in 1993 in Bosnia, it was crazy to talk about intervention. By 95, things had shifted enough that we actually were part of a peace implementation force. That's what I'm talking about, not an invasion force. And there are other places where I could propose that as well. You may say, what's the need for even the one war capability? And I would answer it in five letters, Korea. For now, it has to be Korea. And anybody who says we can start downplaying our commitment to Korea, I would like to debate face-to-face, head-to-head. I think it's just wrong and dangerous. This is still an extremely dangerous part of the world, and the idea that we're going to rely on the South Koreans to handle it all on their own or do the majority of it, I think is a mistake. North Korea now has 10 nuclear weapons going up. They still have a million fanatical, well-armed infantry soldiers. They're well-armed for that terrain and for that kind of fighting, even if they're not mechanized to the extent that they might like to be. And so that's an example of how I would build a 1+2 force. To me, that results in an army of 425,000 to 450,000 active duty soldiers. You can debate the mix between reserve and active. You can debate the exact numbers, but that's a reasonable framework for me. And then finally and briefly on capitalization and modernization, I'm very glad that Jay spelled out where we are in this cycle. We don't have a lot of equipment that's really new, despite the fact that we finally got the procurement budget up a bit the last few years. But what I would say is, we can rethink some of our recapitalization strategies. And to take, for example, one of the aircraft that that Jay's company works on, the F-35, I actually think we probably don't need 2,450 of them across three services. But we do need to replace the aging force structure with something. And I think a mix of F-35, existing fourth-generation planes like new F-16s or F-18s, and also unmanned aerial vehicles, at a greater level, that kind of a mix needs to be purchased in roughly the kind of numbers we're currently intending for the F-35. So whether you believe and stick to that exact strategy or not, you need a high-end capitalization strategy that's robust, at least for the high-end threats you might face. And then you've got to have something to keep the rest of the force proficient, safe, and reliable.
So if you put those kind of numbers together and you do some base closures and you do some reforms in military compensation and a few other things, I think you can justify defense budget cuts that are not as steep as sequestration, but that are maybe $200 billion beyond the first tranche of the 2011 Budget Control Act. Sorry to go on at such length. Let me get to the next question. Ma'am, right here in the fifth row.
Just to follow up, I'm Ronnie Blumenthal. I'm an attorney and consultant here in town. To follow up on something you just said, I am given to understand that there are senior executives and senior officers, generals, admirals, et cetera, tripping all over each other at headquarters operations here and around the world. Is when you talk about sheer numbers, are they planning to cut back on those and just not replace as they retire? Because the support systems for these people are enormous in terms of cost.
Care to take that one, or would you like me to, or Jay?
So, I mean, I probably wouldn't characterize it exactly the way you did, but clearly that DOD has been looking at the combatant commands that they've got, the number of combatant commands to be able to do different regions of the world, and are considering options that would consolidate some of those. That would get at some of the overhead. I don't think that there have been any decisions made on that, but they're clearly looking at that.
I mean, that's my understanding, too, is that that's an issue that's under review, you know, making sure that you have the right proportion of leadership to the forces that you have and require. I've seen several both studies from within the Department of Defense and externally looking at that issue now too. But I would say that I wouldn't quite characterize as people tripping all over each other. I bet if you asked any one of them, they'd say they were overworked and underpaid.
Just to, by the way, one quick point on that. In raw numbers, and you guys can correct me if you remember the exact numbers more accurately, there is something like 2,000 to 3,000 flag officers in the U.S. military, general officer or admiral, 1, 2, 3, 4 star, something like 2,000 to 3,000 total, something in that vicinity. So let's say that each one, between their salary and their retirement accrual, is making $250,000, something like that, a year. So if you just do the math on that, you're getting four for $1 million. So that means the total amount, you know, it's real money, but it's like $1 billion a year. It's not or less. It's not going to be the sort of thing that's going to make a sequestration level difference. It may still be a good idea to do, but it's going to be one piece of the overall fix. We'll go here in the third row. Why don't we take these two together, third and fourth row, and then we'll take Ken's next.
Hello, I want to thank you for this event, and my name is Thomas Stevenson. I'm from the George Washington University, I'm Elliott School of International Affairs. And how would you think sequestration would impact the nuclear forces, our nuclear forces, and special operations.
And we'll take one more in this round before we have responses.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. My name's Sam. I'm here representing Jakes and Associates and Fiscal Track, strangely enough, also from the Elliott University, Elliott School, rather. Mr. DeFrank, you mentioned, and we heard this number from the chiefs, service chiefs yesterday, that it's around 50% of the defense spending that's on benefits and entitlements. We hear the service chiefs talk about controlling the increases of these costs instead of reducing them. So my question is, how important a priority is decreasing the portion of the budget spent on benefits and compensation, and is it even possible?
You want to start with that?
Okay. Well, look, I'm a really biased source because I'm a beneficiary of those. I'm a retired officer. I'm 50% disability. And I'm married to a war orphan who benefited from those things too. But I understand those compensation programs. I understand the rationale behind them. The issue is that they're consuming such a significant portion of the budget, and much of that is off limits, that there are going to be tough choices that have to be made, that if we continue at the rate that we're on, there won't be sufficient resources left for to meet the mission requirements of the force that has to continue. So I think the issue is, that's really what the issue is, but you can't break faith with the people who've served. I mean, a lot of these programs are in place for good reasons, to attract and to retain people who have an unlimited liability clause so that they can feel confident that their families will be provided for. If you look at, you know, depending on how the Affordable Health Care Act goes, if you take a person in my situation who leaves the service 50% disabled and then has to go out and try and find some form of insurance, If you're left trying to buy private insurance, good luck. You know, I mean, you're not going to be in that sort of situation. So now if someone in my situation now who happens to work for Pratt & Whitney and is willing to pay a bit more for my TRICARE for Life, absolutely. But that's a broad generalization that would require some form of means testing in those sorts of areas because it might not be appropriate for others. You know, when my father-in-law passed away, I hope that he was doing what he was doing for our country, confident that his dependents would be cared for, and they were. You know, that as a war orphan, my wife got her college paid for with the GI Bill. It didn't really cover it, but it, you know, it helped so that she was able to go. But these are parts of that compensation package. It's really easy to depersonalize them and make them look like a bloated program, but they're all there for really important and good reasons. So they're not a simple matter to deal with, but they're a real matter because their impact is going to be great on the existing force. So they must be dealt with in a way that keeps faith with the people who are the beneficiaries of them and who have in many cases, through intense personal sacrifice, earned the rights to them, and then yet still be able to have the force structure that you need to go forward. If it was easy, it would have been done already. Because, I mean, I remember from my DOD days, I worked very closely with Dr. Chu, and he was every day aware of this issue. He could see it. He had it charted out, graphed out. He could see what the impact. Now, you know, you're going back, you know, almost 10 years, or it is 10 years since I was looking at the graphs with him. I mean, you could see it as clear as anything you can see in the future, and just what he was looking at is what's coming to pass. It must be dealt with.
Thank you. Jack?
So in the other question, I think that the Special Operations Forces have a definite on spot in the hearts of both the administration and the Congress right now. I think that in the type of environment that they're being used in, they're proven to be especially effective. And I think that there's probably a strong appetite among the political people who make the decisions to be able to preserve them. I think on the nuclear side, sequestration affects nuclear forces exactly the way it faces other forces, because the rules of sequestration, and it is the rules that is the issue here, requires that the percentage cuts be applied across to everybody, so they are affected by that. Beyond that, I think nuclear forces right now are in the political realm more than anything else. Nobody is going to go out and reduce any nuclear forces without any negotiated treaties in order to be able to do that. And any negotiated treaty has to go through the Congress. And so it's a very, very much a political issue. It's not a budget issue from my perspective.
Let's take one last round. We'll take three questions in this round, then we'll wrap up. So Ken, first of the three.
Thanks. Ken Ackman, the Air Force Fellow here at Brookings. Thanks for being here with us today. Jay, this question is probably more for you, but certainly the Defense Department and the defense industry are in this together, you know, as we deal with sequestration to provide capability for the nation. I was wondering just a couple of things. One, you've said that it could, you've talked about, you know, it hasn't fallen very far yet. Could you give us a sense for how sequestration to date has impacted the defense industry or whatever subset of the defense industry you'd like to talk about? And then also, how sequestration, as we look forward to the future, what kind of pressure our industry is feeling with regards to how profitable their businesses are, you know, as profits are released and we understand how much the defense industry is making above just the sheer cost of the systems. If you could talk about those pressures, I'd appreciate it.
Sure.
Great. Let's go ahead and take the last round, then we'll just finish. So anybody else have a question over here, and then we'll potentially take one more.
I'd actually just like to piggyback off that question.
Good.
How do you feel that industry is planning for sequestration? What specifically are you looking for? More foreign arms sales, expanding the domestic market, really just in general what you're doing to cope with a declining defense budget.
And was there one last question in the back, and then we'll wrap up?
Yes. My name is Gil Kim. I just had a quick question on, do you have any indication if sequestration does proceed, when the bottom actually falls out, let's say for the industrial base at some point, factories will close or depots will close or things of that nature? I mean, is there any type of indication if there's a red line or dead or timeline that will occur? Thank you.
Okay, so I think I can answer most of these in a coherent way. First, let me say United Technologies, although we're the 11th largest defense contractor, defense is only 17% of our business. That insulates us somewhat, and I'd say it makes what we do for the Defense Department more important than they are to us. And I don't mean that in a way that our defense business isn't important to us. It's critically important to us for a lot of reasons. But in terms of an overall portion of our business, proportionally, it's not by any means the majority of our business. I'll give you an example from Pratt & Whitney. If we sell every F-135 engine for the Joint Strike Fighter in the 40-year projected life of the program, that's we anticipate that's close to 3,000 engines. We just introduced a new engine for the single-aisle commercial market, and in 5 years we sold 5,000. So the commercial business is certainly the lion's share of what we do. On the defense side, though, the implications are still substantial because we make much of our revenue through the aftermarket side. And so, for example, when flying hours get cut substantially, and flying hours are being cut substantially, that means that the requirement for spares goes away significantly. On the new programs like the F-35, some of you may remember this fight for an alternate engine and things like that. Even when an alternate engine was in the mix before it was ended, at this point in time, based on what the Department of Defense had told us, we had made projections to be building 100 F-135 engines a year. We're building 50 a year. And we did last year, we were projected to have built 100, and next year. We don't see the ramp even beginning till 2016, and it keeps sliding to the right. Now, what does that mean? Well, for one thing, much of the work that's done is done in the supply chain. 30 years ago, we built 80% of our parts and we sourced 20. Today, we build 20% and we source 80. Of our suppliers, only 14% are from Fortune 1000 companies or higher. So in other words, a lot of them are small businesses. We ask them to make substantial capital investments based on projections that the Department of Defense gave us for what we were going to be building. So they made these investments in their companies expecting a certain degree of business in return that they're not getting, and they're just hanging on, and some of them are really struggling, and many of them are very reluctant to talk about it because they're afraid that their investments or employees or potential employees will fear that they're on the edge of going out of business or not really viable. We've asked many of our suppliers who we know are hurting to come forward and talk about it, and there's a general reluctance to do that. And I think that reluctance, to some extent, masks the real trouble that's happening in that area. But my many years at working with the government, one observation, and especially on the space side that I saw, at least first saw there, was that whenever anything's hard and costly for the government, they shift the pain to the right. They move it to the right. And that's what we see happening with the F-35. That's why I don't really take such an issue with Mike's ultimate concern on the numbers, because the numbers over the 40-year life of a program, I think there's so much that can intervene between here and there. I'm just worried about the next few years and the numbers that we build then, and the rest of it's going to take care of itself, because numbers can go up, they can come down. For the F-22, we had made plans to build, engines for 700 airplanes, and we ended up building them for fewer than 200, and the line ended. And that has as much of an impact right now as sequestration, the premature ending of the line. So there are a lot of variables there. But the impact from sequestration is going to continue to build. This is what I said. This is the falling off the Empire State Building and going past the 40th floor. Right now we feel some impact, but it's not a substantial impact. But that impact is going to grow each year as the engines move out to the right, as the spare parts diminish, as training is reduced, and the requirement for them is diminished. Then those small businesses in the supply chain are going to be less likely to make long-term agreements with us, less likely to be viable, less likely to make the capital investments that are required in order to do this. And this can really drive a significant problem because our industrial base isn't what it used to be. Our industrial base is shrinking and shrinking all the way around because the business is shrinking. There just aren't, the requirements aren't there. One of our big initiatives is to have no single source of failure, but to do that is a huge challenge on our part to go out there and make sure we have multiple sources for everything because the volume isn't there. So I would say that the impacts of sequestration are visible today. We can see, looking into the future, that they will continue to intensify. And if what we see happening is that the volumes never materialize, it affects everything from the cost of individual systems, because the costs are based on, it's called the learned out cost, which is a function of volume or dollars. It takes one or the other to drive down the cost. And so as it takes you longer, the costs stay higher, which as the budget's coming down, the impact of the cost staying higher as you're going down. Not that you're not progressing down the cost curve that you agreed to, but your cost curve is based on volume. And as that goes down, the costs go up. And so it impacts even what you're able to do with those shrinking defense dollars.
Thank you. And Jack, your answers to the same questions and any concluding thoughts you may have, please.
So, my business is around the Beltway primarily, so we don't produce product, we produce people. And, it has a clear impact on us with the defense spending if you're in a consulting business. But I think even greater is the impact that what's going on in government right now is having in the consulting business as a whole, because with the exception of health care, I think that government has taken a hit across the board. There's a huge interest in smaller government, and a lot of people who were willing to be consultants and be consultants for the federal government are questioning the long-term viability of those types of jobs. So they're leaving it. You see attrition in companies like mine that are at historic levels, regardless of whether they're just supporting defense or other parts of government, and it's really because of the rhetoric that's going on around town more than anything else.
Let me thank you all for being here, and please join me in thanking Jack and Jay.